Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear arguments from petitioner and Stewart Title versus, and you're going to tell us how to
please the court. This case concerns primarily the duty of good faith and fair dealing. As the court knows, the main issue in this case is whether the duty of good faith and fair dealing applies in a judgment debtor, judgment creditor situation, that duty that was first announced in Arnold. Perhaps a more fine-tuned statement of the main issue in this case ought to be or is whether the judgment in this case created or carried forward that special relationship necessary for the duty of good faith and fair dealing, as it did in this court's decision in Aetna versus Marshall. To a slightly lesser degree, only because they are dependent upon the court's determination of the good faith issue, there are two other issues involved, and that is whether the substantive law of Morreale applies to this case, a case tried before Morreale, and secondly, the issue of the legal sufficiency of an award of the evidence supporting an award of mental anguish. The latter two issues, mental anguish and Morreale punitive damages application, only come into play if there is a breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. The Court of Appeals essentially held in this case that the instant case was controlled by Aetna versus Marshall, wherein this court held in a 2121 claim that a 2121 insurance code claim did survive an agreed judgment in a workers' compensation case. The reason this case is not properly The reason this case is not decided by this court's decision in Marshall is that we do not have the critical fact that was present in the Marshall case. That is, an express agreement on the part of an insurer to continue to provide insurance coverage and benefits. In Marshall, as the court knows, that express agreement and promise to provide additional insurance took the form of an agreement to provide future medical coverage, the same future medical coverage that was in existence, quite frankly, before the agreed judgment. The Marshall case does not apply to this case, we submit, because there was no obligation agreed to or stated, agreed to by Stewart Title Guarantee Company, or stated in the agreed judgment for Stewart Title to continue to process any claims under the owner's policy of title insurance that had been issued to the ILOs a number of years before. The word insurance is not mentioned once in the agreed judgment. The word claim, processing of claim, is not mentioned once in the agreed judgment. The only thing mentioned in the agreed judgment as far as an obligation on the part of Stewart Title was concerned was as a purchaser of the ILO's house. That was their only obligation. The Court of Appeals...
But what was the nature of the claims the ILO's alleged against Stewart before you settled it by the agreed judgment?
The nature of the claim was
what theories?
The theories that had been announced prior in the prior suit. Your Honor, I think they were 2121. No, they were 2121. They were breach of contract. There were several other theories.
So was there a breach of good faith and fair dealing allegation in there?
I'm sorry?
Was there a claim for breach?
I don't think specifically there was, Your Honor, but the conduct for which the alleged duty arose in the prior handling of the claim was certainly barred by the judgment. The question here is not is there a breach of a duty of good faith and fair dealing by conduct that predates the judgment? Because after all, that's what the judgment did. It settled the claims specifically pled and those that could be pled that arose out of those facts. So the question is, from April 11, 1988 forward, the date the agreed judgment was signed, was there a special relationship that would support a duty of good faith and fair dealing, and of course, was there a breach?
Well, is it a correct statement that the agreed judgment is basically the written memorandum of an agreed settlement between the parties carried out in the form of a judgment to dispose of that litigation?
I wouldn't disagree, Your Honor, with that characterization generally of what an agreed judgment is.
With mutual obligations to carry out what you all agreed to do.
I don't disagree with that at all, Your Honor, and that is significant, it seems to me, because you really have to look at the judgment to see what did we agree to do. What we agreed to do was we agreed to pay $319,000. They agreed in exchange to deed us the house, and that's really what that judgment said. Those were the obligations. There is another independent award of cost at the very end, which of course is an obligation, but independent of the amount that was purchased money for the house. The Court of Appeals said that since Stewart was obligated to conduct a closing, that this special relationship of insured continued. I challenge the respondent to point out the words in the agreed judgment that require Stewart Title Guarantee Company to conduct a closing. They are not there.
But there is a provision that Stewart Title will pay $100 a day for each day it does not close past what?
For
20th of one day.
$100 a day until closing papers are signed and funds paid. That's right, Your Honor. But what is important from a Marshall standpoint, and that's...
So what you're saying, as long as you're willing to pay $100 a day, you never have to have a closing?
No, Your Honor. What I'm saying is the closing that is agreed to and contemplated by this judgment is simply this. It's an exchange of a deed for $319,000. It is very, very easy, it seems to me, to get into the trap that I see, and that is that, well, this judgment mentions a closing, so doesn't that mean that Stewart Title conducts the closing? And if that's so, isn't that some continuing obligation? That analysis simply cannot, it seems to me, stand up under scrutiny. First, nothing in the judgment said Stewart was to conduct a closing, but let's talk about what a closing is. A closing is the culmination of the exchange of what the parties have bargained for. That's all a closing is. You have closings in real estate transactions. You have them in lawsuits. You have them in security transactions. You have them in all sorts of transactions. And all a closing is, there's one party exchanges what they agreed, or they deliver the performance they've agreed to give in exchange for the other.
Well, what was your obligation at the closing?
Your Honor, our obligation at the closing was to pay $319,000.
How about this $100? When was it going to be calculated?
I'm sorry?
How about these delay damages? When was that to be settled up?
Well, it was to be settled up when it was paid, and I'm not suggesting that it wasn't owed.
There was a closing in your position. There could be a closing without you paying any additional damages over and above the $319,000. It was closed, and that was it, and you had the right to a deed and a legally enforceable right to a deed as of that moment.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't matter who the check's paid to, or if you find who the right lawyer is, or any of that.
Mike, Your Honor, if there were ever any question about that, the judgment says that the plaintiffs recover judgment against Stewart for $319,000. The next sentence says, upon payment of such sum by cashier's check, plaintiffs will deed over. That's the closing we're talking about. Now, it wasn't by cashier's check. It happened to be by check from the constable's office because it wasn't done as promptly as it should have been done. And I'm not here to defend Ron Mitchell, the attorney who was handling this. I'm not here to suggest that, that he shouldn't have moved quicker, shouldn't have got the money quicker. But the closing is $319,000 for a deed.
Let me ask you this. You didn't feel any obligation to tender additional funds of $100 a day, for instance, on June 30th, to pay $319 plus?
I would have, Your Honor, and I would have handled it differently. I don't know why Mr. Mitchell handled this case the way he did. There's evidence in the record, frankly,
well, I mean, what I'm trying to get to, is it an accurate statement to say that you could carry out your obligations under this agreement judgment by merely paying $319,000 whenever you wanted to, as the Chief Justice suggested, and that you had carried out your duties and you were entitled to a deed? Doesn't, by reading the entire order in the judgment, require Stewart to not only pay $319,000, but if they want to pay on March 21st, they give another $100?
No question that Stewart had an obligation to pay that.
Isn't the homeowner entitled to demand performance in its entirety, not piecemeal?
Your Honor,
say, look, if you come in June and give us $319,000, you still owe it, and you say, no, we don't.
Your Honor,
if
the judgment had said you don't get your deed until you pay $319,000 and $100 a day for every day after March 20th, because after all, Your Honor, March 20th was already 3 weeks prior to the judgment. There was a known amount here. So I think we have to look to what the judgment says. And the judgment is very explicit about when the deed was to be delivered.
Do you agree that Heppner versus Marshall was rightly decided?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Do you agree that Heppner versus Marshall was rightly decided?
Well, I think on the facts of Aetna versus Marshall, I would tend to, I think, have more sympathy with the dissent in that case. But we accept Aetna versus Marshall as we obviously must. I can see an argument that if after a judgment there is something that is required to be done under an insurance policy that you've agreed, since a judgment is in fact an agreed judgment, is the party's culmination of their agreement, I can see that decision and I can understand it because that speaks to the essence of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. This court said we need this duty because parties are in unequal bargaining position. We need this duty because it is the insurance company that has exclusive control of the claims handling process. And without this duty, insurers were left merely at the whim of insurance companies, and all they could do is sue them. So I can see in that Marshall case, it's a long way perhaps of saying that I can see the rationale for that. But in this case, there is absolutely not one thing Stewart Title Guarantee Company was required to do or agreed to do in that agreed judgment under its prior insurance policy whatsoever. When you look at it, what are the settlement papers? What's required by this judgment? It's real easy to talk about generality, but look at the judgment and see, what does the judgment require? If you were to have to sue to enforce the judgment, what is it that you could, in good faith, come to a court and say, I'm entitled to? All the ILOs could do is come to court and say, I'm entitled to money, $319,000, and I give the deed, and then $100 a day. That is all the judgment says they're entitled to.
Are you asking the court to overrule the Marshall case?
No, Your Honor, I'm not. I think this case is easily and clearly distinguishable from Marshall. Absolutely.
In this case, the ILOs could have executed upon whatever damages they were incurring. Isn't that correct?
Absolutely. And their own second lawyer, Jerry Sadler, who testified at the trial, admitted that on the day he was hired, May 20th, 1988. He knew he could go down that day and get out a writ of execution because it was beyond the 30 days after the judgment. So,
in the Marshall case, could the plaintiffs have gone out and executed upon the relief they were requesting?
I don't see how. How do you execute for future medical? That's the difference. Because that's the control. That's the whole reason for duty of good faith and fair dealing, is the insurer has no control. It's the company that has control. And without the duty, they may exercise it improperly. I tell you, when you go from the day before a judgment to the day after a judgment, money judgment, anyone who does not see a significant 180-degree shift in control is, we think, not seeing the true picture. Because on the day before the judgment, the ILOs, if they wanted to go to the sheriff in Harris County and say, help me get my money from Stewart, the sheriff would say there's nothing I can do.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Nelson Hagan will present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court. It's kind of sad that an insurance company would come up here and argue that it should be allowed to act in bad faith to its insurers. You start off with the policy of insurance and the claim under a policy of insurance, which requires good faith in the execution of it. You take that policy of assurance and you stand in front of a Texas state judge and say, we promise to honor the obligations in that policy of insurance, which they don't do, of course. So the judge then has to say, I order you to honor your promise, to honor the policy and the claim under the policy. And Stewart Title would say that in that process of being affirmed twice, once by a promise, an acknowledgement of the obligation, and again by the court ordering them to honor that promise, which they had showed no interest in doing, that something is choked off.
That's a little overstated. The denied counsel, there was not an order. There was a settlement that they agreed to. I mean, there was not after a trial on the merits. There was a settlement entered into.
Well, that's the promise I'm speaking of, Your Honor. And when I speak of the order of the court, I'm referring to the judgment. Because Stewart Title refused to honor their initial settlement agreement, the ILOs, Roger and Evelyn's attorney at the time, had to go back to the court and make that enforced by a judgment. Now, the judgment, they would have you to believe, doesn't refer to a closing, or if it refers to a closing, that's just some sort of sick joke or something. That's not true. The judgment itself incorporates, by reference, the entire agreement. And in that agreement, you'll see explicitly, over and over again, Stewart Title's in-house lawyer referring to all the requirements for the closing. Now, the...
A title company, when they act as a closer, they're not providing insurance, are they?
Well, not always, Your Honor. They don't have to.
Well, that wasn't contemplated here, was it? They would be providing title insurance?
They're simply providing the benefits of the policy. That's right, Your Honor. They specifically wanted a different title company. They wanted Chicago Title Company. They wanted Chicago Title Company to hold the closing. They wanted to have two cashier's checks, one for $279,000 to go through the closing. It was to be $280,000, but Stewart Title wanted $1,000 credit to pay for the new title policy. You see, executing a new title policy is one of the aspects of a real estate closing.
But who was the title policy in favor of?
It would have been... In favor of Stewart Title Company, protecting the ILOs for any claims that came through that. It's usually, you know, the title policy is always one step behind in the chain of command, basically.
But the insured under that policy wasn't the ILOs, it was.
Well, the ILOs to this day remain insureds of Stewart Title Company. A title policy does not evaporate upon payment. It's not like a liability policy. You know, we paid all the claims. A title policy protects you for any claims that come through you to whoever inherits title 10 years, 15 years from now.
And your position is, as long as that relationship continues, there is a duty of good faith in that relationship as long as it has to do with those deeds.
Your Honor, I don't think that's necessary in this case. I think the two factors here is that doubly affirming the obligations under a policy of insurance should not choke off anything. But more importantly, I think, is the fact that the closing was totally in Stewart Title's control. It was very definitely a requirement under the judgment and under their agreement.
What do you mean when you say a closing?
Yes, Your Honor.
What is your definition of a closing?
Well, the Texas Transaction Guide, which Stewart Title refers to, says, the term closing is generally understood to refer to that moment when the parties meet in the office of a title company, etc., to execute the necessary instruments to effect the transfer of title and disperse the proceeds of sale. However, the actual closing of a real estate transaction involves more than the formal execution of documents and the transfer of money. By contracting to sell and to purchase real property, the respective parties become committed to the performance of certain undertakings and obligations that must occur before the transaction closes and title formally passes.
Do you contend there's a duty of good faith and fair dealing and a, as between a seller of real estate, let's say this has just been buyers and sellers of a house?
No, Your Honor.
And how is this different?
This is different in that the closing was to finalize this honoring of the claim, Your Honor. This is all a process of honoring the claim. This is not independent buyers and sellers who come together and do all these things.
The Court of Appeals held that the evidence that you tried to introduce at trial about prejudgment bad faith was barred by the doctrine of res judicata, and yet held that the relationship of insured-insurer continued past the judgment. And don't those seem inherently unreconcilable?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And the reason is because the judge, wherever you pick up the trail, it was simply going back to affirming the obligations under the policy. So I think you can accept the obligations of Stewart Title to act in good faith wherever you pick it up along the trail.
But under that theory, then you should have been able to introduce evidence of pre-settlement conduct of bad faith.
That was always my position, Your Honor. And if the case is remanded, I think that's certainly an appropriate consideration to give, because I think all that evidence very definitely is relevant to consideration of what Stewart Title did.
But, Mr. Hagan, you have a settlement that's been reduced to judgment on your claim against the title company because of a defect in the title.
Correct.
That matter is resolved, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor,
matter was resolved. You have a judgment on that matter, a defect in title for which you made a claim against Stewart Title.
Correct? That's correct.
And that was resolved, was it not?
Yeah, apparently it was not, Your Honor. We thought it was, but apparently it was not. It required...
That matter was resolved.
That case, yes, Your Honor. Okay, I'm with you now.
Now, what you have now, a matter that's not resolved, is simply $100 a day up to the point that your clients received the $319,000. Is that what's not resolved?
No, Your Honor. I disagree with that characterization. Okay. First of all, By operation of law, what the judgment actually says is $319,000 plus interest. Interest is imposed as a matter of law in any judgment. So that must remain unpaid, unquestioned.
And you can execute on that, correct?
Doesn't the judgment have to award it?
No, Your Honor. We cited the case.
It's just out there. How does the executing officer know what rate to apply, when to start it, and when to stop it if it's not in the judgment?
Your Honor, these questions are beyond my capacity to answer. I don't know.
Well, I think it goes to the question of you just saying it's implied, well, therefore you get it, and that's why they breached.
Well, as a matter of law, it's imposed, Your Honor, yes. And that's exactly why there should have been a closing and why the good faith of Stewart Title in complying with its agreement to have a closing was required. So there could be a date certain at which these obligations end.
You mentioned that there was Chicago Title was perhaps to have a closing. Did your clients deliver the deed to Chicago Title in anticipation of a closing?
My clients prepared a deed, and as is replete with the record, their attorneys kept saying, when can we have a closing? Please let us have a closing. You know, let us know where to go for the closing. And Stewart Title refused.
But
refused.
Could you have instituted some procedure to have it closed?
Could the ILOs have?
By delivering the deed, I mean, at a closing, you don't even have to, it's understood that the title company or whoever's conducting the closing will make the transfer of the deed and the money.
Well, that's true, Your Honor. As a matter of fact, the insurance code, Article 9.53, has says there are forms that are required to be used in a closing. That are required to be used in a closing, which obviously there has to be some formality to a closing. In this case, it was doubly important because you had the $100 a day, which could not be fixed until you had the closing. Stuart Title, in acting in bad faith, ducked that question. Now I want to say, well, when we pay part of the principal of the judgment, we can ignore the rest.
When you go to a title company, you don't get a title policy. You decide, in lieu of a title policy, you take a title opinion. Does the title company owe a duty of good faith and fair dealing to the people that come to its offices for the closing?
If they're simply the office for the closing, for example, if Chicago Title held the closing, would they have owed a duty of good faith and fair dealing? I don't know. I don't know what the insurance code imposes with the required forms that they're obligated to do. I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. But I do know that in this case, when the ILOs had a policy of insurance which required good faith, that a judgment enforcing their promises to honor that policy should not have killed off the pre-existing duty of good faith.
Mr. Hagan, returning to my questions, the obligation that is not now resolved is an obligation that was set up by the judgment. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor, although there are certainly additional damages.
There's no obligation here under the insuring agreement that is the obligation of $100 a day is not an obligation that's under the insuring agreement. It's an obligation that's under the judgment.
It's an obligation that Stuart Title voluntarily assumed in wrapping up its obligations under the title policy. So
there's a judgment that requires the payment of $100 a day the day of the closure, is there not?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Assuming it doesn't close on June, whatever that first date was.
The first date would have been March the 1st, Your Honor, originally.
Is it your position that because Stuart Title is an insurance company, that it has, after a judgment's been rendered, that imposes its own obligations, that simply because one of the parties to the judgment is insurance company, there is a duty of good faith and fair dealing?
Excellent question, Your Honor. No, I'm not saying that at all. However good that might be for the soul of the state, I'm not saying that at all.
Under what basis does a good faith and fair dealing duty exist for the payment of this $100 a day until closing?
Well, first of all, we think that having the closing had its own benefits as well, Your Honor. You know, we mentioned that the insurance code requires certain forms that would have set finality. I have a list of 17 different attributes that a closing would have provided.
But that's not a duty that was created. I mean, the judgment imposed, according to you, the judgment imposes that obligation.
Well, their agreement to honor the policy, which was then embodied in the judgment, requires that obligation, yes, Your Honor. It's not just the judgment in this case, Your Honor. They agreed to honor their policy by doing these things. It's not just the judgment here, Your Honor, and I think that your question, would any insurance code, any insurance company subject to a judgment have a duty of good faith to pay voluntarily? I don't think we have to address that question, because here we have an agreement to honor the policy, reduced the judgment, yes, but which retained obligations, specifically a closing, which the ILS could not execute on. And I think that Stuart Title says, you can't make us, we don't have to, this is the coin, the two sides of the coin that they want to cash in and have you term it no duty. Well, if the ILS cannot make them have a closing, there has to be some duty to pursue that, and we think the duty of good faith.
So critical to your position is that the insuring agreement between Stuart Title and these buyers has an obligation to have a closing in it, and since the judgment also contemplated a closing, that's what created the good faith and fair dealing issue. The title policy does require a closing, and so as a result, the good faith follows even though there's been a judgment.
No, Your Honor, the policy provides several ways by which it could be implemented. Stuart Title chose this particular means. They voluntarily said, we want to have a closing. The way we want to execute on the policy is to buy the house from them. And here's how we want to do it. And we'll have a closing, and at a closing, you prorate and you assign your taxes. You prorate the insurance, you assign the insurance. You assign leases, the people in possession of the property. All these factors that, in good faith, should be done when you're transferring a piece of property. And in this case, they said, this is how we want to implement your claim, our policy.
Mr. Hagan?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you arguing that by virtue of the fact that you interpret the judgment to require a closing, that the closing and whatever transpires at that is the basis for the duty of good faith and fair dealing? The closing itself is?
No, Your Honor. It's
the what is then the importance of the closing vis-a-vis the claim that there is a duty of good faith and fair dealing in carrying out this agreed judgment?
The importance is makes it exactly analogous to Marshall, Your Honor, in that the insurance company retains certain obligations or certain duties that it chose to accept.
I'm asking about the duty of good faith and fair dealing, that duty all by itself.
Yes, Your
Whatever
Honor.
Whatever it is, it's a tort claim.
Yes, Your Honor.
So how does a closing per se give rise to that duty?
Not a closing per se. I see your question now. And we're not saying a closing per se. We're saying an obligation, whether it's to pay a medical claim, whether it's to have a closing. This is an unusual circumstance.
I wholeheartedly agree, and that's why I'm trying to figure out where do you get the fact that your argument basically has been the nature of the closing gives rise to the duty of good faith and fair dealing in this case.
Okay, well, perhaps I've been unclear. What my position is, I think more precisely, is that when an insurance company with the pre-existing duty...
No. As Judge Enoch questioned you, you said you've settled the issue of their failure to pay under their title policy.
Your Honor, it was settled by them promising to honor the policy. So, yes, Your Honor, it was...
By what? Buying the property from your clients and paying $319,000, plus if they delayed sending you the $319,000, they pay another $100 a day.
Well, they did promise to pay $100 a day until a closing was held and all the papers were signed. That's correct, Your Honor. They retained control. I think this answers your question. They retained control over having that closing happen.
But you bargained for $100 a day by them having control when they were going to give you the $319,000, didn't you?
That's correct, Your Honor. And here we are, almost 8 years later, still waiting for that $100 a day.
Was the $100 a day a contract of adhesion? I mean, is it something you didn't have any control over, like the terms of an insurance policy?
That particular provision, no, Your Honor. That was something that was
Anything
bargained for.
Anything else in this judgment that was a one-sided deal that you need the particular protection that the state affords to wards and incompetence and insurance?
And insurance.
I mean, people who really can't bargain for the deal. You get my question.
Yes, Your Honor, I do. And I think that the reason it rests here is because the ILOs could not execute on this closing. They could not force them to have a closing to set. Okay, now the $100 a day is due.
But you went whole months. I mean, both sides, it seems, from the fact, went months without contacting each other.
No, Your Honor. The record, the ILOs, their lawyers dictated phone call after phone call after letter after fax, you know, weekly, daily attempts to communicate with Stuart Title.
And always told Stuart who the proper lawyer was.
That's right, Your Honor. That's right.
I'm a little bit confused about the facts of the case with regards to the payment of $319,000. When was that paid to the ILOs?
The end of June, Your Honor.
And the deed was transferred. So we're fighting here.
No, Your Honor, there was still an attempt to have the closing to do the leases, the taxes, the insurance.
So title has never been transferred to Stuart?
No, eventually the title was transferred. Almost a year later, Mr. Fitch sent to me, by that time I was involved, a letter saying, send us the deed. You know, gee, do we trust him? The answer was no, but finally I found the deed and I sent it over to them. And in fact, they could not be trusted, not Mr. Fitch, but Stuart Title, because the ILOs kept getting done for the taxes. The taxes were not transferred. Exactly the kind of thing that you need a closing for, to ensure that liability, ongoing liability.
So, as we sit here, or you stand there, the transfer has been made.
The transfer was made 6 or 7 years ago, Your Honor, yes, of the deed. We don't know, you know, if we're protected from further liability because the closing was never held. The ILOs are still out
closing,
there.
You don't even have to appear at closing. You just sign your papers and you get your deeds. And I mean, that's
right. You have all the papers required by the insurance company.
It's formality.
It should be, yes, Your Honor. It should be a mere formality. And I should simply point out that it's not just the in-house lawyer, Mr. Mitchell, Mr. Madison, the vice president of the company, was called to testify, and he said, yeah, I knew everything that was going on, and no, I never made any attempt to arrange for a closing. They simply ignored that because the ILOs couldn't make them do it. And they now come here to this court and ask this court to dignify
them. Well, to get back to Justice Enink, I think, or somebody else on this side of the fence that said you could have executed a judgment.
Your Honor,
that's how you could have forced their hand.
Well, they did. That's what the 319, they sent a sheriff out to get the 319, thinking now we've got their attention. Now we'll have a closing. No. Even that was not enough, because by then, it's like, I guess they angered the crocodile. It simply became vicious at that point and refused ever to take any step to wrap up the obligations, to remove the uncertainty, the liability on the house. Uncertainty remains, and they ask this court to dignify it. We ask this court to reject that offer.
Mr. Hagan, in a few years before this case, the El Paso Court of Appeals held in Torchia versus Aetna Casualty and Surety that the duty of good faith and fair dealing did not survive the execution of a release.
Will you distinguish
your case from that?
Oh, yes. Well, first of all, there was a release. A release is one of the documents that would have been signed at a closing.
And here there's a judgment, but you said that's different.
Well, yeah, in Torchia, there was a release in which they say, you know, we acknowledge that the underlying claim was doubtful and of uncertain origin, and therefore that extinguished the duty of good faith and fair dealing. Essentially, it was an admission situation. That didn't happen here. That has never happened here.
So whatever the distinction between a release and a judgment, that's the distinction you make between Torchia and this case in terms of survival of the duty of good faith and fair dealing.
Certainly. If the ILS had signed a release saying, you know, our claim was always doubtful, they would not have had a bad faith case, certainly. We also think the distinction is not just the judgment, but the judgment in which the insurance company retains obligations unique, you know, that it uniquely can have performed, which it refuses to do.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Thank
you. Let me just follow up on that last question on Torchia. It is true it's factually different in how the dispute came to the court. There is, however, a very important similarity. In Torchia, the insured argued that I'll be able to set aside this release I executed, which was followed by a judgment. I'll be able to set aside this release I executed on the eve of trial because you tricked me and you violated the duty of good faith and fair dealing when you weren't as upfront with me as you should have been, or whatever the facts were. But it was the duty of good faith and fair dealing that the insured in Torchia said gave them the right to set aside the release. And the court, the very court, El Paso court, said, that can't be. When parties are on the courthouse steps fighting tooth and nail, as they said, it can hardly be said that there is this special relationship in which they ought to, there ought to be a duty of good faith and fair dealing. So I think there's some similarity there. I want to say that they wrote a number of notes here, but I'm astounded. A few minutes ago, I heard for the very first time ever, the acknowledgement, argument, or statement that it is not the requirement to hold a closing that supports the duty of good faith and fair dealing. Throughout however many years we've been litigating this case, the only way that they've ever been able to argue the duty of good faith and fair dealing, because everybody knows it ought not apply to just a judgment debtor, judgment creditor, they're not arguing that. The only way they've ever gotten there is to say you had some insurance, kind of amorphous insurance duty to, quote, conduct a closing. There is no requirement that Stewart conduct a closing. But that's the way they've gotten to Marshall. And now, today, I heard for the first time, no, when questioned about, well, what is a closing?
The closing is you cutting them a check. They give you a deed.
That's exactly.
Simple. And you refuse to do that.
We Your Honor, there was a dispute about the delivery of the deed. This record isn't quite as painted by counsel. I'm not defending Mr. Mitchell's delay of 2.5 months.
Mr. Mitchell, Stewart Title's contract.
And Stewart Title is bound by that. I absolutely agree with that, Your Honor. Their testimony reflects Mr. Mitchell didn't keep Stewart very well informed about what was going on, but we're bound by that. What this is a breach of contract case. You're absolutely right. All it was deed for money. Stewart delayed 2.5 months in paying the money. They shouldn't have. The ILOs delayed 15 months after they got the money in delivering the deed. They shouldn't have. And that's the way this case should have been tried. It was a breach of contract case. I couldn't agree more. And frankly, to torture a breach of contract case into a bad faith case is, we think, not warranted by this case. I will say one other thing. There was a dispute as to the $100 a day. There was a dispute as to whether the $100 a day was intended to be in lieu of interest on the judgment. That's why $100 a day wasn't paid that summer. The record reflects that in September, just 2 months after the judgment was paid, Stewart cut a check of some $23,000 or $24,000, went to the offices of Mr. Sadler, the attorney for the ILOs, and were told that Mr. Sadler was no longer the attorney. Mr. Hagen was now the attorney. Stewart tried to pay that. I just want that to be clear. This isn't quite as, the picture isn't quite as it was painted. But the bottom line is, there is no duty of good faith and fair dealing in a judgment debtor, judgment creditor situation, even when the judgment debtor is an insurance company. There's just no basis to find a special relationship. We respectfully request the court reverse and render, as did the first time it was decided by the El Paso court. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. I appreciate the argument.